Ice cold beer!
Popcorn, peanuts, Cracker Jack.
I know what the big deal about Cracker Jack is. Did you ever go and buy a pack of Cracker Jack thinking you'd get a prize and find no prize in the box?
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
To the ball game, take me out to the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. We'll root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 1, 2, 3 strikes you out at the old ball game.
All right, welcome back to the Bench Jockeys here on 101.5 UMFM. I'm Michael Alves, and joined from a safe distance, my pal Brian Svensson.
Hey, hi, howdy.
Over on the Zoom dugout machine, we've got Chris Zook.
Hello, everybody.
And our special guest tonight, it is Al Svensson, a.k.a. Brian's Pops. How's it going, Al?
It's great. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. Last week, ladies first, we had Diana Svensson on last week. This week, you know, we go from a Cubs fan to a Yankees fan. And so I have to ask, were you born in New York City?
No.
So how on earth do you become a Yankee fan?
Well,
are you from Connecticut?
No. I'm a little bit older than you fellas. I date back to when, to enjoy baseball, we didn't get a lot of television. We had to read about our teams, and of course, when we were able to watch games, it was maybe a Saturday afternoon game. And then in the playoffs, we would get to watch some night games. And I guess it was around the mid-70s when I started to really appreciate baseball and started to find my enjoyment of it. And that's when the Yankees were just starting to get into their, as Brian would not like to hear this, but that's when they, in my opinion, they started to, for me at least, started to become a great team. And they were starting to get back to their winning ways, you know, with the addition of guys like Reggie Jackson and Billy Martin. That was a lot of fun to watch when we were able to watch, as those two guys go at it. And they were winning World Series again. And yeah, so that's kind of how I started to enjoy the Yankees.
So what was it, like, other than winning, why did you gravitate to the Yankees?
They were just, you know, getting to watch and read about guys like Catfish Hunter and Craig Nettles and Bucky Dent and, again, Billy Martin and George Steinbrenner being larger than life. And Brian, I'm sure, has told you, if he hasn't, I don't like to lose.
No.
I've heard this, yes.
So... most of my teams that I do cheer for, you know, they strive for excellence, and the Yankees are one team that, you know, they're not afraid to win. They're not afraid to spend the money to win.
You picked the right team, Al.
And, you know, listening to you guys, you love it when the players get paid. So I'm surprised that you guys aren't Yankees fans.
Yeah, we do like it. We do love it when the players get paid. That's for sure. That is for sure. So I don't know. Let's just say I appreciate the fact that the Yankees do pay players, but I don't necessarily like all of their players. There's a lot of their players I haven't liked, and they have had quite the cast of characters, right? Especially some ones that have been on the wrong side of baseball law, A-Rod and Giambi and Clemens. So they're not really afraid to break some rules as well.
Well, you got that right.
Well, you know what? I will say this. You forgot to mention one guy from the late 70s. There's a guy named Bucky Dent who kind of crushed.
He did mention him. He did, yeah.
He did mention Bucky Dent.
I missed that. What about Chris Chambliss? Remember that guy?
I did. I do remember. Also, Big Lou Piniella.
I love Big Lou.
Sweet Lou.
Sparky Lyle and Mickey Rivers. And
oh, yeah.
They actually... before they won, I think before they won the 76 World Series, I think they acquired Mickey Rivers by trading Bobby Bonds. I think. There you
go. Oh, Barry's dad.
Yeah.
We'll have to fact check that. So the movie that we watched was 61, the Billy Crystal one. About the Maryson Mantle home run race. There's several Yankee baseball movies, no surprise. Is this your favorite Yankee movie?
To be honest, it was the first time I'd actually sat down and watched it. I had seen, you know, bits and pieces of it, but I hadn't really sat down to watch the whole movies. So I can't say that it was my favorite.
Right.
But I did enjoy it thoroughly.
So obviously this period, I mean, this is the 1961 home run race between the two of them, predates your fandom. So that was like established lore in your Yankeedom.
Predates his birth even.
Right.
I'm not quite that old, but.
No, I'm not trying to say you're that old. I'm just saying like you became a Yankee fan after this was already well-established history. So it's not correct. Like you chose to be a Yankee fan. Because of this lived experience. But as someone who chose to be a Yankee fan in the 70s, 15, years on from this period, like how big a thing was Maris Mantle and the 61 homers in, late 70s when you're choosing a team?
It was, again, it was part of the Yankee lore. And, once I had decided that the Yankees were going to be my American League team, I started to read and learn more about them. And, of course, the legends like Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and, for a short period, obviously, Roger Maris. And we could recite the Yankee legends from Babe Ruth and all those guys till we've only got half hour, so we really don't have enough time to talk about all of the great players that the Yankees have had and the people of New York and the rest of the baseball have had an opportunity to watch. But it was an very interesting story. That's for sure. Those two when they were chasing the Babe.
So we'll turn to the movie itself. I guess maybe we'll start with you, Al. Did you make any notes? Is there anything you wanted to highlight in watching the movie?
Well, I guess we could maybe start with something that was kind of silly in a way. What the heck were those eggs that Roger Maris was making Mickey and Bob serve? They just looked disgusting.
They looked disgusting.
So I want to know how they ended up looking blue, right? Because he's grilling bacon in a pan, right? So it's basically just bacon grease that he's adding the eggs to. What accounts for that blue hue, right? Like it should basically just kind of be like brown. Or like slightly orangish looking eggs from that bacon grease.
Unless they are burnt.
But wouldn't they just be black then, not that weird blue?
You'd think so. I'm not entirely. Those are really gross looking eggs. Maybe blue cheese, but blue cheese isn't exactly fully blue, right?
No, it's more white with a little tinge of blue.
Yeah, so I have no idea, but they looked awful. I think I would want to eat.
They were a nasty piece of business, that's for sure.
Yeah, I ended up watching because I have the DVD of this movie, and I ended up watching the special feature. There's like a behind-the-scenes making of mini doc that's about 50 minutes long. And there's no mention of the blue eggs, unfortunately. There's lots of other great tidbits, but nothing about like that breakfast choice.
I mean, if they're hitting home runs after him, then I'm superstitious enough that if I'd ate them once and hit a home run, I'd keep eating them.
I gotta be honest. I've been to the Roger Maris Museum, and I believe that's in
it's in Fargo.
Fargo,
yep. Fargo, right? It's the Fargo Mall, right? Mm-hmm. And no mention of eggs. So I don't know. That might be just a little bit of embellishment in the old movie.
It's kind of crazy that because of our geographical positioning, we are uniquely positioned to both talk about this movie in some sort of reverence and also have all been to that Roger Maris Museum.
Well, if you've been to the mall, that museum's right there. It's pretty, you know, you don't have to pay for it. You just go in and it's not very big. And it's actually kind of cool. I've sat through and watched a bit of that reel, and it's kind of cool that a lot of people get to see it because it's in a mall, as weird as that sounds. But people get to know who Roger Maris is, especially younger people.
Yeah, actually, that museum had an impact on me, both the museum. And I saw this movie. It's funny that my dad had never really watched it up until this point. But I'm sure, you know, he says he'd seen clips of it. Well, he's definitely listened to the whole thing because we ended up having a bootleg VHS copy of this that I watched in the back of our Chevy Venture on a trip to Minneapolis once on a VHS attached to a block of wood.
I don't even want to know how you got a bootleg of that.
I don't remember. I honest to goodness don't remember. I think it was a family friend that had gotten it for us, but I remember watching it. I remember watching this in the back of our minivan on the way to Minneapolis for a baseball trip. We were going to go watch the Twins play.
And you drove this bootleg VHS across state lines. I tell you, how many crimes, federal crimes, are you admitting to committing right
don't
now?
Don't tell anyone about that. Don't tell anyone.
Considering Brian would have been underage at the time, he's tossing his old man under the bus.
That's what we do to Yankee fans on this show.
But it was I have a very soft spot in my heart for Roger Maris because of both the movie and that museum. So
I'm going to be honest here. I don't think, unless you love the Yankees, it's hard to be a Yankee fan because they win so much. But here's the thing. The movie, I think, very underrated movie. I think it's Barry Pepper who's the lead actor, is Roger Maris. I think he's fantastic. Both in the Mickey Mantle, it's great with the relationship. But I think Brian's totally right. Is the there is an affinity because he's sort of because he's a Midwest guy. He's like us a bit, right? Roger Maris that was the also ran from Mickey Mantle. Everyone in Mantle to win the record, and yeah, you kind of pull from a bit. And I think actually the museum kind of gives. It gives him a little bit of stature because he's never going to be a Hall of Famer, but he beat Babe Ruth. And I just think, the way they told it, obviously it's from Billy Crystal's perspective, who is a huge Yankee fan. And you see that at the end of the movie, but yeah, it's just kind of made with a lot of heart there. And it's a very underrated baseball movie. A lot of people don't talk about it, but I thought I love watching it every time it comes on TV.
Well, Crystal had a lot of insight. He became very good friends with Mickey Mantle, so he got a lot of stories that he was able to put into the movie.
I want to watch a documentary about their friendship, because watching the like special feature thing afterwards, like, so he first meets him when he's 8 years old, because his dad takes him to a Memorial Day doubleheader, and they're sitting in Louis Armstrong's seats.
Oh.
Because his dad worked in the music business. That's and so awesome. They got very close to Mantle. He got an autograph. And then in the mid-70s, he's on the Dinah Carroll show and re-meets Mickey Mantle, brings the program with him, shows him the autograph, gets him to sign it again, and then they strike up a friendship. And this is like one of those like weird things where like they continue to hang out and chat and throw the ball and stuff. And it reminds me of that story about the 13-year-old kid from Wisconsin who became friends with Jackie Robinson and became like pen pals. It's like, that's the story I want to hear about.
Yeah. And I mean, Mickey Mantle too was, you know, say what you want about his after hours activities, but in the public eye, like this guy was a bona fide, legitimate, like superstar. And not only that, but he was like a very good, I don't want to say role model. Role model is the wrong word, but he made himself available a lot to fans. Well, he signed everything. If you put a piece of paper in front of him, a baseball in front of him, he didn't care. He signed everything. He was, you know, my dad has made mention of this from his time as a Jets fan. You know, that Bobby Hall used to sign it would stay late, stay until every single person had gotten stuff signed. Mickey Mantle was the prototype of that. He would stay until every single person had gotten their piece of memorabilia served, even until well after he was done playing baseball. In fact, there are so many Mickey Mantle artifacts out there with his signature on it that it's relatively inexpensive to get your hands on one.
It's widely available. I think the one thing, there's a great scene about, I think, when both of them are coming into the stadium and all the fans are kind of asking for Mickey's autograph and he's signing, and then sort of Roger Maris' character is kind of shy about it, and then he gets a sign, but he signs it with an X, and then the guy goes nuts. And it just was that Mickey Mantle was bigger than life in some respect, I think, back in that day. And Roger Maris, you know, I think they portrayed that very well about sort of the stress. Like, I never knew. I mean, again, it's movies, so they're going to embellish a bit. But yeah, I think, you know, I think if I remember, especially from the museum as well, Roger Maris went through an incredible amount of stress. Because people, you know, the death threats they show in the movie, people didn't want him to get the record. They wanted, if someone was going to get the record, it wanted to be Mantle. I mean, Babe Ruth's widow didn't want the record to be broken, let alone from Maris. So I thought it was just well done about sort of showing about the tension between, not really the two of them, but between people who were cheering for one and not the other.
Yeah, the columnists that they you know, sometimes quote throughout the movie, you know, talk about kind of, it should be a more heroic figure who breaks the Babe's record. And then Maris has kind of an interesting thing to say about like kind of like earning respect. And he's like, I don't think you can earn respect on a baseball field. It's what you do elsewhere. And like, that to me is like a mark of his heroism, that he knew what he was doing on the field was just a game, and that who he was as a person was ultimately more, that he was more responsible for. But of course, like, that's partially why the Mick was the beloved, you know, poster child of the Yankees, and why Maris was the Yankee that Yankee fans didn't like.
I mean, they are hilarious. If you go back, like, they one of the things that they highlight in the movie is like when they start up that M&M corporation and start doing the commercials, you can go on YouTube and watch some of those commercials, and they are just as comically bad as they make them out to be in the movie. They're hilarious to go watch now. They do one for Alphabets, like the cereal. Good Lord.
There's a lot of athletes that aren't very good doing their commercials. They're pretty.
No, I guess that is fair. Yeah. It is. No, it's still funny to watch though, regardless.
Oh, so much. So I agree.
So the other thing that I found, well, a couple things I found fascinating in watching the afterwards. So Anthony Michael Hall, who plays Whitey Ford in the film. So Ford was a lefty, Hall throws right. So what they ended up doing was they put the number and the NYs on backwards. Like, they stitched them in reverse on his jersey, had him throw righty, and then they flipped the footage to make him look like a lefty.
Oh, that's so smart.
And they also had, they actually had Tom Candiotti play Hoyt Wilhelm, I believe.
Yes.
So it was a true knuckleballer that was towards the end of that year when he was that his 60th he hit off of Wilhelm, or
he actually didn't hit any off of Wilhelm, but they sent out Wilhelm specifically to prevent him,
to ice him. He'd hit the 60th in the game.
Yeah.
And at late in the game, his last at bat, Hoyt Wilhelm comes out, and I had made a note. The angle that Candiotti's wearing Hoyt's hat is very, like, I don't think 1961 pitchers wore their hat at quite that cocked an angle, but
no, probably also, not.
I also thought, and I'm not real sure again, because I didn't watch game. I wasn't born then, but even seeing rare footage from that era, the visiting teams that the Yankees played, like the Yankees jerseys look pretty realistic because they haven't really changed over the years. But when they faced, I think they faced the Twins in the movie, and I think they
faced so the opening day they're against the Twins, and then they do play the Orioles, and you see them play the Tigers.
I thought the uniforms looked more closer to today's era than back then, but I could be wrong.
The 61, the Orioles are definitely wearing the 61 bird, that really stylized kind of outline drawing of the bird.
The Twins, I think my dad's right about the Twins uniforms, though, they are very, very modern looking. You'd probably be the best to comment on that, Mike.
Yeah, and it's funny because, I mean, I did make note of the fact that it's like the Twins are there again, because we keep watching the Twins in all of these movies.
Well, I think they use them in this movie to highlight specifically the fact of the expansion, right? Because the Twins were one of the expansion teams that year, and they were using the Twins specifically to highlight, oh, well, the talent pool is diluted. There's a lot of bad pitchers in this. And, you know, they were using the Twins to be like, oh, these are one of the expansion teams, right? New teams.
Yeah.
I also found it kind of coincidental or kind of interesting that Maris finished his career with St. Louis, and then it was McGuire who ended up breaking Maris's record.
You know what? Look, can I just say something about this? Because right now we're stuck with watching a lot of old baseball on TV, and they showed McGuire hitting 69 and 70 against my Montreal Expos. From 98, and the scene of, like, you know, it was just jubilation, and he has like 18 curtain calls that game. And I don't know if you guys remember this, this is actually true, because it was also backed up in the museum when they stated this. When Maris gets 60 and 61, it's not sold out. People are not it's not like the pursuit in 98 was with McGuire and Sosa. People are not flocking to the stadium to watch him break the record. And I found that fascinating.
Well, the commissioner of baseball at the time, Ford Frick, really did his best to make sure that people didn't think it was a real record.
Yeah, right.
That's true. That's
true. Yeah. I did appreciate the "this guy died and nobody told him" line about Ford Frick.
Yeah. Yeah. God, Crystal takes some real pot shots at Ford Frick. I mean, I don't really have a lot of knowledge. I've read some stuff about him, but there isn't really a lot of information, inside information about the kind of person that Frick was. Apparently, he was just really uptight.
Well, I think there was a connection with Babe Ruth.
Right? He was his ghostwriter.
Right. So, I mean, I think he was protecting sort of the legacy of Ruth. I think.
Frick was, trying to protect Ruth and his record, or whether he was backpedaling after the fact. He did go on record, and I believe he was quoted as saying that he never did say that if Maris or Mantle were to break Ruth's record, that there would be an asterisk. I think what he did say was that there would be two entries in the record book,
right?
Because of the different number of games that Ruth would have played, and obviously Mantle and Maris, because I think that was the first year where the American League had expanded to the extra games. They had extra teams. The National League was still playing at the old number of games. I think it was 154.
That's correct.
And they hadn't expanded their teams yet. So whether he's being, you know, truthful or not, that's kind of what Pinky ended up saying about it.
Right. And obviously they kept that rule until sort of like the separate records till 91, 6 years after Maris's death, at which point they said, oh, you know,
I think he also said that he wasn't 100% sure that the American League would stay at the 162 games that they had started in 61. He thought that they may have gone back to the, again, who knows what he was trying to do. They sure made it in the movie, at least they sure made it look like he was protecting Ruth and Ruth's record.
One thing they had a really good scene about he was trying to break it at 154, right? That they set up, I think, the wife to watch the to try and watch the game for that.
Yeah, at the television station. Yep.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was they were kind of really emphasizing because.
And that's the game in Baltimore where he gets iced by Hoyt. Well,
yeah.
And so I think that's sort of where the answer comes if Frick didn't say it specifically, but I think it was out there that once the 154 was passed, that people view this in a different light, regardless that, you know, he still broke the record, but they didn't see it as the same because we did in last game.
I think the kicker to that, the, like, you know, the cabal of sports writers and Ford Frick and all this kind of machinations is that ultimately it's, to me, it just registers as like another instance in which like baseball is more concerned with preserving the fast than the past than like celebrating what's actually happening right then and there.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I agree. Right. Like we are currently in an era where we are witnessing maybe the best baseball player to have ever played the game. And the long time it took people to recognize, or at least some people to recognize that, and be the constant fighting from, you know, some people saying that, like, well, you know, no, he's not because of all these other legends. So that's fair. But at the same time, it's wild to me that, you know, I mean, this has just been a problem with baseball for a very long time, is that, you know, there aren't enough people kind of living in the present.
There's no doubt. I will say one thing, the sense you get, and maybe again, because maybe Crystal kind of points it a little bit that way in the movie, but if Mantle was the one who was on the precipice of 61, right, would have been different, right? Would have been different where people have kind of said, ah, it's Mickey Mantle, we'll give it to him. I think it was protecting Ruth, but also that, like we said at the start, that it wasn't this Ruthian figure, right? This wasn't Paul Bunyan doing it. It was just Roger Maris, who was kind of a journeyman that's going to break the record.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
A couple of hat tips to Billy Crystal. Because I think this was his directorial debut. He has a couple of really nice flourishes that I like. So the opening sequence is, of course, the like modern day of Mark McGwire pursuing the home run record. And it transitions to Maris catching a ball in the outfield off of the McGwire hit.
Yeah. And
the ball tracking. I really like that, like the way that it transitions into the older part of the movie. And then he does another thing where when they're visiting Detroit, when Mantle and Maris get called into the visitor's manager's office, there's a Detroit program sitting on the table. And then it cuts from that to the guy hawking the programs in the ballpark. And it's just like a couple like really nice like little flourishes to kind of transition. I really appreciated that. One other tidbit that I hadn't realized till I watched this time is that the woman who plays Maris's wife is Billy Crystal's daughter.
Oh, did not know that one.
Huh. Very cool.
And he talked about casting Barry Pepper because he saw him in Saving Private Ryan and couldn't get over how much he reminded him of Roger Maris.
I mean, Barry Pepper was a fantastic choice. Not only a terrific actor, but he did a great job, I think.
Yeah.
But he also looks the part. Like, he is Roger Maris, right? If you've seen pictures of Roger Maris, like, it's a pretty good spitting image of that guy. Like,
yeah, they look very much alike.
Yeah, pretty uncanny.
Did you guys catch that Shooter McGavin from...
Yes, of course, yes.
Yes!
There's so many, like, of those, like, there's two Wire guys, like the Dominic Lombardozzi's in this, Seymour Cassell's in it.
One of the doctors Bruce from McGill. House. One of the doctors from House is in it. He's the guy that really, really goes at...
sports writers.
Yeah, he's one of the sports writers that really goes at Maris. I'm forgetting his name off the top of my head right now, but he was he's in House. Peter Jacobson. plays Chris Taub. Yeah. Just incredible. So many that guys.
Yeah. So speaking of Christopher McDonald, is he playing Mel Allen? At one point he calls the Tigers the Huckleberries. And I wasn't sure.
I've never heard that before.
I forgot to Google that because I was like, is this something that the Tigers were called at one point? Yeah. So that's for future research.
I did have a question for you guys pertaining to, I guess, the movie and also the chase of Ruth's record. If Mantle hadn't decided to take a shot from or take a needle, I guess, from some funky backstreet doctor to clear his flu that gave him that massive infection in his hip.
God, that was gross. Oh,
that's, yeah.
Like, and I guess, you know, medicine back then was, you know, wasn't anywhere near as refined as it is.
Apparently
today.
It was like eggs.
Well, he would think that a team like the Yankees would have had team doctors that, you know.
Probably the best ones.
Well, you would think.
But Mantle might have been, he might have gone to a different drummer, right?
Well, and that's true. But my question is, if he didn't have such an infected hip by taking that shot, do you think he would have broken the record as well? Or do you think it would have made it easier if he didn't break the record, if he would have made it easier for Maris to achieve the record, having that insulation in the lineup?
Still being pushing each other.
Yeah.
I think he would have got it.
I would go the other way and say, I think it would be a lot like Maguire Sosa. I think they would have pushed each other, and I think Mantle probably would have, you know, what did he finish, 54 that year?
Yes, he did, in 153 games.
Okay, so I think he has 58 or something like that, and Mantle might have even had more than 61 because he goes through that stretch of 6 or 7 games just before the end, before he hits the last two, that, you know, that they fed off each other, right? And I feel like Maguire Sosa sort of fed off each other in 98. So I'm going to say I still think Maris gets it, but Mantle would have pushed them and maybe even pushed them higher.
I do wonder about the medical staff, because that training room, the facilities seem pretty sketchy, and all Mantle's being treated with is a bucket of beer on his knees after the game. So I'm not sure what kind of medicine they were practicing in the old Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, it's certainly would have been close. I mean, Mantle hit 54 in 153 games, which is it's slightly under one every three games, basically. You're hitting one in slightly less than three games. So if he continued on the pace that he was on, he would have hit 5 more home runs over those over the remaining games that were left in the season. Would have put him at 59.
And you know, it'd be interesting because would they have pitched to both? Like, we'll never know, right? Like, that's, you know, would have been harder, easier because they're both in the lineups. I think that probably helped that they couldn't just, you know, pitch away from one guy. I think that's what Maris saw at the end, because there was only him in the lineup and not Mantle, where they had to, you know, pitch to one of those guys.
Well, what about you, Dad? Do you think he would have gotten it?
I don't know if Mantle would have. But I do think that, again, the combination of them pushing each other, but also not that Maris wasn't having a great season, and he had a couple-ish really good power seasons with the Yankees. But I think having Mantle hitting behind him certainly helped him.
Well, Maris never had another good, like, great season ever. He wasn't even technically the better player that year. I mean, that was the last truly, like, historic Mantle season. He put up 10.3 wins above replacement, never again going over 7. Maris was 7.2 that year, was 7.1 the year before. Maris never again got over 4. So
I think Maris was an MVP before this year, if I'm not
mistaken. The year previous.
He won the MVP the year before.
So, I mean, he wasn't just a flash in the pan. A lot of people forget that. Like, he was a solid career, but he had one amazing year, and there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, he had 2 great years. He had a couple more years where he was in a, well, I would say about 5 more years where he was above average player. But you know, there were 2 years, this year and the year before, where he was an MVP caliber player. It's crazy. Out of nowhere, he just puts up 2 MVP caliber years, breaks the home run record, and then goes back to being a pretty solid right fielder.
Well, with that, we have to wrap things up and hand it over to Front Burner. Al, thanks for joining us on the show tonight.
Thank you very much for having me and listening to the old man ramble on a bit.
It's less about your age and more about your Yankee fandom, but we appreciate it nonetheless.
And I'm looking forward to this pandemic being over so that I can head back down to Minneapolis the next time the Yankees are there and watch my Yankees take care of business again. Sorry, Mike.
Oh, you got to leave on that note, huh? Surprised I didn't mute you already here.
I'm just kidding. I'm just having fun with you.
I'm sure. That's the Yankee version of fun. All right. With that, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next Friday here on the Bench Jock.
Strike 3. You're out.